I even change some things I haven't changed. For instance, I don't believe there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. But I just think as a practical matter, it's time for society to make a legal accommodation, you know, and address that. And, you know, I'm the same way about things such as medical marijuana. And quite frankly, I could be for decriminalization of marijuana if I could figure out how, as an employer, you know, I know that people aren't coming in high, or more so, and Scott, I know you were a prosecutor in Macomb County, and I was in Wayne County. You know, how if someone appears to be under the influence, you know, it's a lot easier to tell if it's alcohol than it is marijuana, and there's no practical way to test for it. The test for marijuana don't tell you that the person's high right now. What they do is they tell you that they've gotten high over the past 60 days. And so it's some of those practical matters to figure out. But I think it's incumbent on any thinking person in a free society to be able to change their opinions as the facts change.
Well, that's really true. I mean, just think about 30, 40 years ago, would we be having the discussion about, well, in the 60s, was there a discussion about legalizing marijuana? I mean, let's face it, we were young, you and I were young in the 60s, but that was the turn on and tune out. And yet, you know, they really found, and this is my personal belief, they found that the harder drugs were so debilitating, you don't see people arguing for the legalization of dropping acid now.
No.
But it was, I think, something our society went through, but they were talking about legalizing marijuana. They weren't really talking about it for medical purposes back then, though. And that is one of the difficulties with the current issue, is this current medical marijuana referendum has been so difficult, one, to prosecute, and also to work in the industry. They wanted it to be where you can actually make money as a business in it, and that's been very difficult, and it's been difficult for prosecutors, too, to know what to do on it.
Absolutely. The lines aren't clearly drawn. I myself, personally, we already have a system in place for the dispensing of controlled substances, and you know that's pharmacies. I would have no issue with someone going to the pharmacy and getting medical marijuana. I think that makes the most sense, but I don't think the legislature is there yet. And quite frankly, it would kind of drive out. It would clean up the business, make it safer for patients, and knock some of the fringe elements out. And I myself personally think that's the way to address the issue. And because I know some, I'm 51 now, so I know more people who've had cancer than I did when I was 31. And I've had friends or family members, and not all of them can react to other painkillers. And sometimes marijuana, for whatever reason, is the best. And so I view it quite simply as one of those medical, maybe necessities is overstating it, but it's a medical reality that some people's bodies react better, or long-term chronic pain, cerebral palsy, things like that.
Sure.
But getting back to your larger point, it's one of the great things about a republic, and one of the is that we get to talk and debate these things. And one of perhaps the bad things is that we can't turn on the dime. And maybe that's a good thing, too, because then perhaps we don't overreact. But it's an interesting time as a lawyer and as a citizen right now, that's for certain.
We're talking to Mike Cox, your former Michigan Attorney General. And now, of course, you're in private practice. Do you take on these issues in private practice? Are you going on and taking on the government as opposed to before where you were representing the government?
Yeah, you mean, am I taking on the man where I used to be the man?
That's right. What are you doing?
Most of my business is commercial litigation, one business fighting another one. But I have a few clients who are under the eye of the government right now. are being looked at as criminal defendants. It's a small part of my practice, but I find it interesting, and the issues are important. And again, it's a small part, but it's something I enjoy doing.
What's that like going from government, and not even just government, I mean, you were the head of that. How many lawyers did you have under you? I mean, you had a lot of people under you.
Yeah, at the end, it was 251 because we had to downsize. When I first got there, it was like 287.
What's it like to go from something like that to now your individual practice, and you're obviously representing private parties? I mean, how do you actually transition like that?
It's a lot of sleep, you know, not going to bed. You know, I never pulled an all-nighter when I was in college or law school, but I have since I've been in private practice. And actually, I'm up to four lawyers now, so it's a little bit less stressful. But at the same time, I'm having a ton of fun, and you know, I hesitate to say starting at the bottom because it's not starting at the bottom because it's. It's a great place to be a sole practitioner and having your own agenda and helping people. And that's what attracted me to being a lawyer, was the ability to advocate for people and to help people. And for 23, 4 years, it was, you know, crime victims and the people have been scammed or governmental entities that needed advice when I was attorney general. So now it's a different set of folks I'm helping, but it's still a lot of fun, and I'm here in the office on Saturdays, and I don't begrudge it, and I'll be probably here tomorrow because it's fun.
Well, it's tough. Let me tell you, I know what it's like on both ends, and that's really tough, too. I can't let you go before I get a comment on the Wayne County Jail. What is the story with that? I was just reading about that again this morning, where, you know, it's so over budget, and they're stopping the building now. And if you know where it is, of course, you know where it is. And
yeah.
It's such a prime piece of real estate, and you used to work right across the street in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. Why would they want to even build it there in the first place? Why didn't they think about Mound Road facility before?
You know, they have this love of beautiful new buildings in the CEO's office in Wayne County. It's everyone wants a building with their name on it, and I think Mr. Ficano or the people around him wanted that. And, you know, I remember a number of folks, quote-unquote, called it a no-brainer, yet my wife, who happens to be on the Wayne County Commission and voted against the jail, was 14-1, and people yelled at her that it was a no-brainer. What's the matter with you? Well, now we see what the issue is. The county could have rented the Mound facility for $1 a year.
Right. A dollar a year.
$1 a year for 99 years.
That's got to be a no-brainer right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, there's some security. It's a little bit harder for security, but, you know, between the courts and going out there. But it would have been way cheaper than what they were doing. And Scott, as you know, there, it's uncertain how many, that they're minimally $100 million into it. And even if Dan Gilbert comes along and buys it, whatever way this happens, even if that happens, they're going to lose $50 to $100 million in sunk costs. If they continue on, it's going to be dramatically scaled back, and it's not going to deliver what they said it was. You know, unfortunately, it was mishandled by Mr. Ficano and his cronies, and the taxpayers of Wayne County are going to pay the price once again.
Well, it's, you know, when they're talking about selling off the assets for the DIA, and we have this white elephant sitting there, that is just a crime. That is unbelievable. Well, we're talking to former Michigan attorney Mike Cox. Mike, thanks for coming to the show, and don't be a stranger.
All right, you take care, Scott.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Time for traffic.
All right, we have bad news if you're on the road. An overturned tractor trailer is causing major gridlock. Cleanup crews are trying to remove the wreckage, and traffic is backed up for nearly 12 miles. If you don't want to be stuck in your car all day, make sure you absolutely avoid route.
Please deposit 25 cents for the next 3 minutes.
Radio. You shouldn't have to pay for it. This message brought to you by America's 13,000 local radio stations who believe some things were just meant to be free.
All right, let me ask you a legal question. How many lawyers do you know? How many lawyers do you trust? When you get in trouble or don't know the answer to a legal question, who do you call? Well, now you have a network of lawyers you can call right now at 800-7100-LAW. Hi, I'm Scott Weinberg, host of Courtside Radio. Any legal question you have deserves an honest answer. A lawyer you can trust. Don't just settle for anything less. Whatever legal question, text the word ADVICE to 313131 or call 800-7100-LAW. If I can't answer the question, I'll make sure one of my lawyers will. Guaranteed. Text the word ADVICE to 313131 or call 800-7100-LAW. That number again is 800-7100-LAW or text ADVICE to 313131. Get the justice you deserve.
Are drugs affecting your family or a friend? Call Narcanon, 1-800-468-6933. Narcanon provides free assessment and referral services. Call Narcanon at 1-800-468-6933 or visit our website at stopaddiction.com.
Let's rejoin the Courtside Radio Show with your host, Attorney Scott Weinberg.
Welcome back to the show. You know, we were talking with former Attorney General Mike Cox about the issues, not just of privacy, but also of, you know, what it means in today's society to, as it were, change. You know, you can change your opinion. Listen, I can jump all over former politicians that aren't involved now because they flipped up on different issues, whether it's marijuana, whether it's gay rights, or whether it's internet privacy. That, to me, is not helpful. The issue is, are people willing to stand up when they have changed their mind and make a difference? And that, to me, is credibility. That's what I feel. That's the way I vote. That's the way I deal with people. That's the way I deal with judges. You know, you can have a judge, and one day he can think of something and he can say it. And if he literally has been changed because of a different argument, and he changes his mind or opinion, then they should have the guts to come out and say that. You know, we're talking about the internet, and we're talking about what's going on with this national security problem and the controversy it's raging all over the country now with the FBI and the National Security Agency trying to seize this information. And, you know, we're just reading the news about it. It's been going on for years. We're just reading about it now. We're just waking up to the issues, right? That we're connected every single minute of every single day on our social media. We wake up. What's the first thing our kids do? Wake up, we go on Facebook. Wake up, we'll check our email. Wake up, we'll put on our Google where we, it's check. It knows where we are. It knows what we're doing when we're searching. We are telling the world everything about ourselves. And now we're shocked and surprised that the government is somehow taking assessment of that and seeing what we're doing. Where were we? You know, we're checking into our companies at work with our ID badges, and it keeps a record of what we're doing. We use our credit cards every single day. Why do you think those companies want us to be able to have all our information on the computers when we log in? They want to be able to data mine. Why do you think they want to be able to have all that information on our purchases? Because the companies want to find out all of our purchasing habits, all of our information. And now we're shocked and dismayed that somehow the government is going to be able to have access to that. Well, where have we been? I mean, what are we thinking, that somehow this is going to be innocuous, that they're not even going to pay attention to it? Well, we find out now that that really isn't the case. We're joined here by Professor Devin Shingler, a professor at Cooley Law School, constitutional law professor, and we need help. We need help, Professor, understanding how are they able to now, as it seems, spy on us under our Constitution. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I was listening to your discussion before I got on, and I find it very interesting, a point you made. Fact of the matter is, really, at the end of the day, not a lot new under the sun. We've had glimmers of these particular programs, speaking of the PRISM program, which allows the government to access internet information, and the other program, which collects data regarding cell phone calls. We've essentially known about this in one form or another since 2006. it's really only risen to sort of our attention because of the recent leaks. But as you pointed out a moment ago, this has been going on for years. So the justification for all this really begins, of course, as so much does in modern society in today's world, with 9/11. Where the government, through the Bush administration, passed a series of laws, which I'm sure you've spoken about before, known as the Patriot Act. It goes by various names, but I'm going to use the Patriot Act. Over the years, that act has been modified, and the powers that are given to government have, in some cases, increased, in some cases, been checked. But essentially, since at least 2006, Congress has given the president, essentially, the government, the authority to tap into both the Internet, which is the prison system, and also collect what we call metadata, massive amounts of data regarding our use of cell phones. So, been around for a while. It's really nothing new under the sun.
But it's also where, I mean, we can think about it, that we have our ability to, let's just say Facebook. I'm going to just use an example, right? So we put information on Facebook. Is it safe for us to think that Facebook isn't sharing that with the government? Are they not sharing our personal passwords or our information that we don't want other people? Because I've clicked on that privacy spot. Is that being shared, or do we have a choice?
Great question. I think the answer to that question turns on two things. In Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, where we talk about no unreasonable searches and whatnot, the court has developed this doctrine known as the expectation of privacy. And so if you're locked up in your home and have all your drapes down, what you're doing in your home, you have a reasonable expectation that the government's not going to look at you short of probable cause and get a warrant. Facebook, in my mind at least, is different. Facebook is out there for the world to see. Granted, you can put some security settings on it, but ultimately, in most cases, I think about my daughter's Facebook. She allows hundreds of people, literally hundreds of people, to observe what she's up to day in and day out. Twitter, same thing. We allow hundreds of people, dozens of people, whatever the case may be, right, to access our information. Well, you open that door a little bit, you essentially open the door all the way. In no way, in my mind at least, can someone place something on Twitter or put something on Facebook without essentially waiving their expectation of privacy. You know, you give it to 30 people, you can't expect the government not to look over your shoulder.
Well, that is exactly right. We're talking with Cooley Law Professor and Constitutional Law Professor Devin Shingler. We're also joined by prominent criminal lawyer Todd Flood. Todd, how you doing?
Hey, great. Great, Todd, Scott. Just watching my son's basketball game.
Well, that's good. Hopefully he's winning. Listen, here's the story. You know, on a practical matter, what happens if you're in court? And let's say that they want to use someone's Facebook page that they thought was they wanted to be private, right? They didn't necessarily make the whole world their friend, but now are they allowed in the local courts here to use these Facebook pages? Like, for instance, can you use it to cross-examine someone?
Absolutely. I do it on a regular basis. Regardless of what you think is a secure private matter, when you expose it to the world or expose it to friends, those friends don't have any right to, I should say, they're not demanded or somehow can't put it out to the rest of the world. So you basically lose an expectation of privacy. Expectation of privacy has been pretty much brought in through case law. It started off the genesis with cats, and it's a two-pronged test. Is there a subjective expectation of privacy? That means, is it in your mind? And then, is there an objective? Is it reasonable to the rest of the world? So when I post something on Facebook to other people, is there an expectation of privacy that's reasonable? No, there isn't. Now, I think to your earlier question, though, that's something different. And we saw that with Kwame Kilpatrick a little bit. That is, can Facebook share my passwords? Can they share this private company? Can they share my personal information with the government? And that's a much bigger question. I think there is an expectation of privacy because there is a third party that you have a contract with and that you're doing it with a reasonable expectation of privacy, i.e. my social security number, i.e. my password, i.e., you know, certain things that I only know and that I share just as it relates to security.
Right. I mean, it's got to be that expectation of privacy. Just, I mean, quite frankly, when we're giving our information out, do we have to always be careful about who we're giving it to? Of course we do. Professor, sure. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I like the distinction Mr. Flood makes between passwords and whatnot. But at the end of the day, if the government can show probable cause, they can obtain a warrant. The real question is, can government do it with or without a warrant to this sort of private information? And again, the short answer is, government can get to about just anything it wants, including what you're doing in your bedroom, if they have a probable cause and the judge is willing to sign a warrant. One of the issues we have with the revelations in the last few days is that this judicial check to make sure the government doesn't go too far afield, provided by courts and the warrant situation, in the context we're working with now, all of this is done by the FISA court. The FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, is a secret court.
A secret court. I mean, that to the public, Professor, that to the public, I don't think they knew, at least predominantly knew, what that even was.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. It's an interesting part of the Patriot Act where Congress and to a lesser extent the President recognized that giving the executive branch, FBI, NSA, whatever it may be, unfettered access to all this information really destroys the checks and balances. And so part of the Patriot Act and its various permutations sets up this secret court. It's essentially made up of three judges from the D.C. Circuit that their day job is to do these sort of the run-of-the-mill, everything, everyday sort of things that courts do, consider cases, contracts cases, whatever the case may be. But their side job, if you will, at night, if you will, is that they consider warrants, their warrant requests that are submitted by government entities confidentially, secretly. Their opinions are not published. Their decisions are not published. The pleadings that are filed with them are not published. And, of course, it's all ex parte, which means if you're a target of one of these, you don't know. It's the government essentially going in front of this secret court and saying, we think that Devin Schindler has been involved in this terrorist activity. We want to tap into his Facebook. We want to tap into his email accounts. And you never know it's happened. You never know it's happened.
You know, Todd, one of the things is a practical effect as a practicing attorney. Can you imagine if that was in, you know, Wayne County courts and we had no access to any of the courts like that? It was the secret court that was issuing these warrants?
Well, that would be a scary situation. What the professor is talking about really has not been tested in the courts. And you and I spoke about it when we talked about the Boston bombing and what they could do and what they couldn't do and what the government has under the Patriot Act and what the president has kind of solidified is going after and all the information they can get on terrorists. And they hide under this umbrella oftentimes to advance the ball in capturing criminals that they believe are suspects in terrorist activity.
Right. I mean,
could imagine in a state case, though, when it's not involving that, that would be, to me, there would be a huge uproar. And the court needs to test the viability of this and see if there is a constitutional breach as it relates to your Fourth Amendment.
Professor, where is the Supreme Court with this? Is it going to be considering these issues soon?
It's a great question. The problem that we have is about 2-3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, the Supreme Court issued an opinion in a case known as Clapper, where there was a challenge to the wiretapping or eavesdropping that was being done by the NSA and others on international phone calls. And essentially, a group of plaintiffs that did lots of international phone calls, human rights workers and lawyers, sued saying, you know, we may be being listened to without probable cause. This violates the Constitution. The court dismissed this case. Again, this was just the last month or so. The court dismissed that case, saying that the plaintiffs didn't have standing because they couldn't prove that they were actually being listened to, which leaves us in a very bizarre situation where unless you can prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that, in fact, your information has been collected, and again, all of this is confidential, you don't really know, you can't even bring a lawsuit to challenge it. So we find ourselves in this extremely odd situation that we may have a constitutional violation that, because of the standing requirements, the court never decides upon.
We're talking to Professor Devin Schindler and Todd Flood. You know, do you think, given the nature of our current Supreme Court, that it is going to change, that they're going to shut it down? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, assuming that we can ever get a case up to the Supreme Court, and again, that standing issue is a major issue, but assuming we can ever
they'll get a case like that. They'll get that over the next couple of years.
So sooner or later, I suspect someone's going to be harmed by this interception, and yes, I suspect you're right. But in any event, sooner or later it gets up. I think Surprisingly enough, I think the court will put some limits. They're not going to eliminate these programs, but it wouldn't surprise me if under the Fourth Amendment doctrine, they require the government to only access information upon probable cause. In other words, that they raise the standard and make it much more difficult for the government to access information. And part of the reason I say that is Justice Scalia, just in the last couple of days, has written a dissent and an opinion in another case where he has essentially recognized the importance of this right to privacy. And so you take Justice Scalia, you add in the three or four so-called liberal judges, and I don't like those terms very much, but the so-called liberal judges, and suddenly I'm looking, I've got five judges that have essentially come out in the last couple of years and said, hey, we need to reexamine these privacy cases from the history, from the past and reflect them, bring them up to date based on current technology. So I think the votes are there not to eliminate the program, but certainly place additional restrictions upon it.
Well, you'll have to keep us up to date on it. Thank you for coming to the show, Professor Shingler and Todd Flood, and at least giving us the practical practical experience of what's been going on with this. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Thanks.
After Sergeant Matthew Kyle was injured in Iraq, his young wife Tracy faced the daunting task of getting their VA benefits.
There's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of forms to fill out.
For years, paralyzed veterans trained experts have helped injured veterans and their families. National Service Officer Bobby Hager explains.
We're able to fill out all of the forms and applications and ask for all of the benefits that that veteran's entitled to.
To help, visit pva.org.
Talk dirty with me. Not like that. I'm Wendy Mountain on Plumbing Professors Radio every Saturday, 11 a.m. on WDFN. We're the experts, and we'll talk dirty about all your plumbing, sewer, and drain problems. Or visit plumbingprofessors.com.
All right, let me ask you a legal question. How many lawyers do you know? How many lawyers do you trust? When you get in trouble or don't know the answer to a legal question, who do you call? Well, now you have a network of lawyers you can call right now at 800-7100-LAW. Hi, I'm Scott Weinberg, host of Courtside Radio. Any legal question you have deserves an honest answer. A lawyer you can trust. Don't just settle for anything less. Whatever legal question, text the word advice to 313131 or call 800-7100-LAW. If I can't answer the question, I'll make sure one of my lawyers will. Guaranteed. Text the word advice to 313131 or call 800-7100-LAW. That number again is 800-7100-LAW or text advice to 313131. Get the justice you deserve.
Some look up to the Man of Steel and others follow the lines in the web. But I look up to my real life icon, my dad, and calling him anything less than great would be misguided. In his warm arms, I confided all of my fears. And as my time to rear others grows near, I'm reminded that women marry men just like their fathers. And I hope that's true. Anything less might as well not even bother.
A message from the National Fatherhood Initiative, the Ad Council, and this radio station. Visit fatherhood.org for more information. Have you been a dad today?
Let's rejoin the Courtside Radio Show with your host, Attorney Scott Weinberg.
Welcome back to the show. Well, you know, in our remaining minute, I tell you, that is the reaction that we need to have in this country, which is basically we need the public discussion. I agree with Obama. I do about that. We need a public discussion about it. I just don't agree with the fact that they're what they're doing. I mean, I don't buy the fact that we should just follow along with whatever that patriotic says. I don't. I think we need to have, and I'm telling you, it is going to be attacked on both sides. For Obama, he is going to be attacked on both sides, Democrat, Republicans, Independent, about what just happened over the this revelation over the last week. And he, look out. He thinks it's hot. He thinks it was hot in California. Wait till he gets back to Washington. It's going to be extremely tight under that collar. So stay tuned. We'll always be following that, and we'll talk about it next week. Thanks for listening. This is Scott Weinberg on the Courtside Radio Show. Take care.
Join us next week for the Courtside Radio Show with your host, Attorney Scott Weinberg.
Case dismissed.